How's everybody doing? Hope you're having a fantastic day. So I am here on my Saturday morning stream with Classical Theist. So how are you doing, CT?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. So this is kind of continuing my recent desire to have some new people on my Saturday morning streams. Kicking Hassan to the curb. I'm just joking. Hassan will eventually be back again. But I just wanted, to have some variety for the Saturday morning. So next week is actually going to be River Run. And then the week after that, I have my debate with David Erhan. So there's going to be nothing that morning. So, CT, I guess I'll cut right to it since you have another like 55 minutes, right?
Yeah.
So I've never heard don't dox yourself, but I've never heard kind of like your general background. Did you grow up Catholic, convert, revert? How did that go?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was raised Catholic, not very well. I mean, my mom tried as best she could, but my dad never really was too much in it. And so I was sent to just kind of a normative Catholic school environment. Wasn't very well catechized at all. Wouldn't have any like solid introduction into philosophy or any of the preambles to the faith, or and even what they presented of the faith wasn't very well done. So naturally, I kind of upon entering into secondary school, I kind of just fell off. But I was always had kind of an interest in philosophy. I always had an interest in those kinds of questions. So I just looked to who I thought was articulating answers to those questions in a way that was better than, what I was exposed to. And so as a teenager, I was kind of drawn to people like Dawkins, like Hitchens, like all those guys, just as a teenager.
It's so over.
It's so over. Yeah. I just got to pack up right now. But no, I mean, so I started with that, I threw off what I considered at the time to be like the shackles of the faith and tipped my fedora and all that stuff. So, but I kind of very quickly came to realize that even the shallow catechesis that I was given was not being represented well by these atheist types. Like they were saying things that were just clearly not reflective of what like the church actually taught. And so that led me to be a little bit suspicious of those guys. So I entered into a little bit more, I guess you could say, quote unquote, sophisticated stages of atheism through people like, I mean, Russell's not that much more sophisticated than people like Dawkins, but he's a little bit of a step above.
Are you talking about Bertrand Russell?
Yeah. But then I spent a lot of time trying to refute Christian arguments. Mm-hmm. Like cosmological arguments and such, like the Kalam and things like that. They have a weird fixation with that one. I found Fager's blog, and I don't know if you remember that article he did a long time ago, So You Think You Understand the Cosmological Argument. Well, I read through that thinking, okay, well, this is just going to be a breeze. I'll just easily refute this. And I came down to, okay, I really don't understand it. I don't understand it at all, actually. And at that time, I had already sort of dabbled a little bit in St. Thomas, even as an atheist, because I was sort of impressed by his use of Aristotle for his ethics.
Mm.
And that impressed me a little bit. By that time, I was already a little bit, I had become a little bit more conservative, morally speaking, opposed abortion, pretty much opposed like premarital sex and things like that. Mm. Obviously, I didn't have a sense of strict obligation with those things because I didn't have a conception of universally morally binding principles at that time.
Yeah.
But I was attracted to St. Thomas's treatise on beatitude.
Mm.
And I just foolishly thought, okay, well, I can take this without God. I can take this without the ultimate end for the sake of which all of it actually exists. But I saw Fager's blog and I thought, well, maybe I'll give St. Thomas another try. Maybe, you know, his ethics sound pretty good. Maybe his metaphysics are good too. And so that was really the beginning of the end for like any last vestiges of atheism, agnosticism. Took some time before I made the connection between the classical theism that I had come to accept and the foundations of Christianity, but mm-hmm. there. And then I really just reverted. Now it would be 10 years ago, 10 mm-hmm. years ago. And I've really been on just a steady track of deeper and deeper study and thought ever since. So that's really kind of my background, I guess you could say, in terms of reversion.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess my background's a lot different.
Yeah,
I never went through like an atheist
yeah.
phase or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I can't really like get in the headspace because a lot of people do ask me like, hey, you're interested in St. Thomas and you're very interested in De Deo Uno. So why don't you ever do stuff on the existence of God or mm-hmm. or anything like that? It's just I that's just not an interest to me. But now I kind of get why you're on that train sometimes of anti atheistic arguments.
Yeah, you know, I just feel like I think it's gotten better in terms of the broader exposure to this way of thinking about God, like the Catholic intellectual tradition, generally speaking. I know there are a lot of differences and divergencies between, you know, Scotus and Thomas and others, but I think there's a lot more similarity among Catholic scholastic approaches to this question. There's a lot of similarity among them on the one hand, as opposed to what you find in, I think, the more mainstream presentation of like arguments for God's existence that you find from like Craig and others. So I started off doing content where my mission was just to bring about wider exposure of that tradition insofar as it approaches the existence of God. And that's really all I was interested in at that time. And then it kind of just branched out into, which is why my current, you know, moniker, classical theist, I mean, it still applies very much, but I think people understand that I've branched out well beyond that fixation.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, so where does the whole, this might get me in trouble. Where does the whole like America first, stuff kind of fit into,
oh yeah,
this narrative?
Well, you know, what's funny.
Well, was that something that was like pre,
no,
conversion days or,
you know, what's funny is, so like I did well into my atheism, I kind of grew a little bit more conservative politically, mm-hmm. but not that much. Like I still believed in all sorts of things, funky things like liberalism, universal suffrage, and crazy things like that.
Yeah.
But so my coming to faith had nothing really to do with politics at all.
Mm-hmm.
My initial stages of atheism, I was just a typical like liberal, progressive liberal. So it was really just purely out of philosophical and metaphysical interest that I had entered into theism first and then Christianity secondly. But after that, I think it just became obvious to me that if we take this stuff seriously, if we really take this stuff seriously, and it can't be metaphysically compartmentalized to where what we believe about God and the moral life, insofar as it's divinely revealed to us, the precepts of God, the counsels of God, all of these preconditions for holiness and sanctity that are presented to us by the church, if we believe that those map onto a universal picture of reality, ultimately, then it just doesn't make sense to kind of carve out this exception to all of that in the political sphere. You just have to, it's totalizing. Yep. It's, and this totalizing effect of that, simply, it just kind of made me almost overnight like a right-wing reactionary, just politically. Just I saw that as a metaphysical, I saw that as a logical consequence of having assented to prior metaphysical and then theological notions, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I got into that. Since my interest in theology was through the medieval tradition, I didn't really have any patience for modern political projects. Mm-hmm. So I just saw pre-modern ways of thinking politically as just so inextricably linked and bound up within the broader metaphysical and theological medieval synthesis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so. Why? I guess I'll push in a little bit deeper. Why yeah. Specifically America first? Because I mean, I could see, is it something that's a little bit more pragmatic? Because obviously, I'm sure you would agree that Nick Fuentes isn't exactly, you know, like a pure integralist of the highest order. And I don't think that's necessarily required to be in his position. But is it something more pragmatic as you kind of see this as, you know, pushing in the rightest direction, the best direction out of anybody out there? And you think that he could be a major force for good? Is that the angle that you're coming at it from?
I would say primarily, but I also think that he touches on some issues that I think even most politically interested and politically engaged, like mainstream conservative Catholics, don't touch, mm-hmm. and yet are found within the Catholic tradition. Mm-hmm. And I don't see them really engaged with by even the most like hardline Catholic commentators, like people like who I obviously disagree with theologically, like I'm not SSPX, I'm not any of that, but even like people like say, take someone like Taylor Marshall, for example.
Yep.
He prides himself as being this mega trad, this ultra super duper mega trad. And yet, and I'm not going to be too explicit because I know we're on YouTube and everything, yeah. but he doesn't touch, I think, the one issue that I think you know that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's not really touched very much. And yet you find it not only in prior ecumenical councils of the church, you find precisely Nick's articulation of that issue in, I believe it's the Fourth Lateran Council.
Mm.
You know, Nick's articulation of like the woman question, for example, that I think you would very much agree is mm-hmm. his articulation of that. And when I say his articulation, I mean his most refined articulation. You got to strip away some of the exaggerations and ironic jokes that he makes all the time. But I think his most refined articulation of that issue, you know, for example, have you read St. Albert the Great's treatise?
Yes, I have.
On some of his treatises on animals. Women.
Yeah. Oh, his treatise on what?
Like animals.
Oh no, I read zoological his, work. The pseudo Albert's De It's called On the Mystery of Women.
Well,
actually, that's about like medieval embryology. So I guess it's it's not
well,
like too relevant.
Well, for example, like I have a book called The Summa Zoologica, and it's kind of a compendium of a lot of St. Albert's works on that, and he touches the question of women on that ish on that in that compendium. And I don't have it with me, so I can't. And if I honestly, if I did quote it, you'd probably get banned because his remarks are. Like if you take Nick's comments on women's and St. Albert's comments on women's, St. Albert's are more misogynistic than anything that Nick has
which
said.
Is based.
So I'm just saying that
joking guys.
So I'm just saying that like Nick takes these hardline positions on the one issue that I think you know what I'm talking about.
Mm.
I'm not going to articulate for the sake of your channel.
Yeah.
And you know, the question of women, and not only the question of women, but also, you know, you say Nick may not be like an integralist of the highest order, but he does explicitly profess integralism. Like he does say that we, like America should be a Catholic state. America should be like a confessional Catholic polity. And he is like a supporter of like monarchism and things like that. And that is all very obviously well-rooted in the tradition. So like on that issue too, I think he takes positions on issues like universal suffrage that I think are more in line with the more traditional teaching of the church. And so you take these issues and, I kind of see him as like one of the only people who's pushing for a political movement that is in many ways predicated on precisely a commitment to Catholic integralism, just generally speaking. Like that is his platform. I think it's that's become his platform more explicitly over the years. It didn't start out fully that way, and I think it has shifted more towards an explicitly religious and overtly religious political vision. Before it was, I think the fixation was more on, you know, race and just politics in general. Now I think it's taken on over the course of years a more overtly religious political message. In other words, he's insisted more explicitly on the indispensability of Catholicism in particular in political activism. He's become much less ecumenical, for example. So I just don't see that amount of zeal and commitment to that reflected in any other political leader of any kind.
Yeah, I think the real, obviously the question of the issue that we shall not speak of and that I usually don't speak of, but I share basically your views on, but the other issue, the woman question, I really do think that the woman question becomes a litmus test. If anybody out there is just interested, actually the document I found to be most helpful is one of the original drafts, schema of Vatican II, this draft of a dogmatic constitutional chastity, marriage, family, virginity. And it's really interesting because it goes over a lot of the teaching of the church, the magisterial teaching of the church.
I mean, when, you read like Arcanum Divinae, you read, like Leo XIII's Arcanum Divinae, you read even Casti Canubi and other magisterial texts, and it's inescapable, you know. And sure, it has, I think, more of a harsher tone among more ancient authors, like among the fathers, like among Jerome and others. But still, the recent magisterial texts on this issue, and by recent, I mean like 200 years, within 200 years worth, you can't really say that stuff in polite company today. And so it's still quite extreme, and it has never really been reversed. I mean, the closest reversal I think that you could point to is maybe you find in Francis's Amoris Laetitia what he says about women's emancipation, you could argue, like, might come into conflict with what Pius XI says about that. But in such a case, I think Pius XI is speaking much more authoritatively than Francis.
I think even with Francis, what's interesting about him is he actually, and like the big issue with me is once you start sort of the ball rolling with a lot of these women issues, and the reason I actually think it matters for Catholics to talk about it, maybe not in like, you know, the sort of, I think a bit cringe and distasteful, Timothy Gordon way of going about it.
Yeah.
Like just calling dudes cucks and stuff. Like
this, yeah. I mean,
it's just like ridiculous.
And if you see my timeline, like I don't talk like that or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think where we do actually fall.
But
into
I do like Tim. I don't want to like throw him under the bus. I do like him as a guy, but.
Okay. So like pastorally there's actually, I think, pretty severe issues once you start down the road of practical feminism. Mm-hmm. And when Pope Francis speaks, he actually understands this. It's really weird because you think, you know, Pope Francis, the big feminist. But when Pope Francis speaks pastorally about marriage and family,
yeah,
the roles of mothers, the roles of wives,
true.
Women's role in the church even versus men's role in the church. For example, he had a airplane interview where somebody asked him about women priests or women deacons or something like that. And he started to go into the Marian versus the Petrine roles in the church.
Yeah.
As like an example of men and women's role in the church.
And that was very helpful, I thought.
Uh-huh. I do think when we look at basically any pastor with pastoral experience, which Pope Francis definitely is somebody with a great deal of pastoral experience, they understand this. It's mm-hmm. just, you know, they're I'm not going to say scared. It might be a bit of prudential. It might be a bit prudential, not to just, you know, go out there and be too explicit about it. Although personally, I am usually very explicit about it. So maybe Pope Francis actually provides us with a good example of how to deal with normies about these issues without having them just like lose their minds.
Yeah, you know. There is a little bit of a disconnect, though, it seems, between what he says in that context and that less formal context and like the direction that he takes the church, like in terms of his governance. Because on the one hand, you're right, like he does affirm those things, but he is also, unfortunately, I think, opening the door for the kind of discussion about the role of women in the church that I think will ultimately be unhelpful. So there is that disconnect that is unfortunate, but
yeah, I think something that I've been gives me a lot of hope is every time Pope Francis gets asked about something like female deacons, because I mean, technically speaking, while I would think it would be a terrible decision, Pope Francis could fill a lot of leadership roles with women. That's just a fact. He could do that.
I'm wondering.
The constitution of the church would not be destroyed.
Right.
It would suck, but you know, it is what it is. But every time he gets asked about women in major holy orders, which would actually just, it would be game over basically. Not that I think it could happen because, I mean, you might disagree with me on this, but I don't think it can happen, but if it did happen, I think it would be game over. But every time he gets asked about those issues, he's actually very, very hardcore against women to diaconate and women to priesthood.
On that point, though, I think you raised an important point. We shouldn't shy away from the falsifiability of our faith. Like, not that we concede like an actual possibility of it being falsified, but we have to concede that there would be scenarios under which papal claims, for example, would be falsified. Because if you could actually show that there is a contradiction between two like ex cathedra papal teachings, that would be a problem, because otherwise you'd have to modify your view of papal infallibility that makes it essentially impotent, because you would basically just be saying that, well, the Pope is infallible just whenever he's not contradicted by some other infallible teaching. And in that case, then I'm infallible and you're infallible whenever we like, just, it's not a charism anymore. And we have to be honest about that. Like, and I think being honest about that actually fortifies my faith, because if you look throughout 2000 years, there are some contenders for that. Like, some people will bring up, you know, that apparent contradiction between like John the 22nd and who was it? Nicholas, the, I forget which Pope Nicholas, but on the question of apostolic charity, some people bring that up, some people bring up Pope Vigilius, some, you know, so there are contenders, like potential contenders, but I think the close examination of those cases reveal not a real contradiction. And that's pretty stunning, you know?
Yeah. I think at least for myself, because I've thought about this a lot, and I think this is actually what it makes the, you know, there's a sort of attitude amongst the, a lot of the people that follow both of us. It's just general online Catholics, where a lot of them are converts. I mean, I have no problem with converts. I'm a convert myself, but amongst converts, it's like, okay, here are my top five denominations. Catholicism gets 98%. You know, I kind of you know, struggle with this and that by Pope Francis. I think Pope Francis is a little bit cringe, so that takes off 2%. Orthodoxy's got a solid 80% because, you know, they deny the Filioque, and I'm pretty sure about the Filioque. And then they just keep going on. And they basically say, if you ask a lot of these people, like, what would happen if Pope Francis decided to start ordaining female priests? And for me, I'm like, well, when you consider the motives of credibility, it's physically certain that God has stamped his approval. God, who is truth and can neither deceive nor be deceived, has stamped his approval upon the Catholic religion. So
what part would of the happen if the
What would happen if the Catholic religion was false? I don't know what I would do. I don't know. I'd probably go to like Montana or something and like live the rest of my days in the wilderness out there somewhere. I don't know what I would do. But a lot of people, they said they would just go to second place. That's what a lot of people would do.
I see Christianity as just so interconnected with like these Catholic claims, because the virtue of faith is one. It's unified. It's a unified virtue. And as St. Thomas says, you can't really lack faith in any one article without compromising the rest of the articles of faith. And so for that reason, like, I don't have like a list of other denominations that I would go to if Catholicism were falsified, because I don't think in that way. You can't really compartmentalize the articles of faith in that way. So I think it's kind of all or nothing.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I mean, I really mean it, that I would probably just become like a nihilist or something, or some weird like Cartesian demon is like, is somehow like confusing us, because it's true. It's like from the consideration of the motives of credibility, it's not like you can just, you know, and this is I think the problem with a lot of internet religion is it really is just like a pick your own adventure religion. Religious experiences
like, you know, an RPG game, like
it's like, okay, tomorrow I'm basically going to become like old calendar Russian Orthodox, and then next week I'm going to become Miaphysite, and then the week after that I'm going to become Set of a Contest. And it's where is the sort of is this what Christ promised?
Right.
Well, that's the question you'd ask. Is this what Christ promised? Is this the faith that had fed so many saints and martyrs? No, it isn't.
There's a virtue of consistency. Faith. It's a habit in the soul, so it has to be stable in order to really have it. And so I'm very distrustful of people who like become Catholic, but have like. But this is like their 20th conversion over the past like 2 years. And it's not that God can't work with people under such a scenario, but I feel like those people, if you really do tend toward that kind of instability in thinking, you should be off the internet. Like, this is not a good place for you. Like, you should be seeking spiritual direction from somebody off the internet, off the grid. And you should be praying. You should be picking up like the liturgy of the hours. You should be picking up your rosary. You should just be like, your whole initial stage of conversion should really be primarily focused on prayer, and cultivating the virtues. And when you cultivate the virtues, guess what? Your virtue of faith will be strengthened. When you cooperate with that grace, the virtue of faith will be strengthened, and it will become a more solidified habit, and you won't be in this constant state of like mental instability with respect to other religions. So that's just a little thing I had to say about that.
Yeah, I think the big issue for because I get asked sometimes by like priests or theologians or whatever, or whoever I'm talking to, and they're kind of just like, okay, I kind of want to know about the sort of your age group of like Catholics. And
you send them that like Convertidox meme.
I do. Every single time I tell them, I'm like, the big sort of pastoral issue that you have to deal with people in their teens and 20s is to keep an eye on the reverts and converts, and to make sure you are properly leading them in the ascetical life, in preparation for the reception of the sacraments. And then after that, when they do get into theological study, to make sure that they're coming at it with the proper dispositions. Because I mean, there are people in our community who I am sure are doing apologetics or whatever on a lower or even unfortunately higher level, and I'm really not sure how many of these individuals are recognizably Catholic in their personal lives off of the internet.
Right.
I think, and this is actually, like, to me it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. I mean, we can look at the Orthodox and we can say, oh, look at all those uncharitable ortho bros who are, you know, probably never go to divine liturgy and blah, 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 blah. I think in our own camps, it's actually because of this distance the internet provides us, and because there's this lack of accountability that the internet provides us, I am sure there's a lot of skeletons in a lot of closets.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I think the more time you spend on here, the more you realize that that is the case. Definitely.
Okay, Fed. Somebody asked. Oh yeah, I have. he's 16. I have a very good question for you from the chat. So, classical theist, where do you live? What's your full name? Where do you work?
Oh no. well.
You don't have to answer that. I'm messing.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Okay, so who's your favorite saint besides Aquinas?
Oh, that's Well, that's just, you know, there are sorts of categories of saints. I feel like I don't really like that quite. Like, I don't really like. There are so many different saints that fulfill different spiritual needs. So, like, just picking like one favorite is kind of I don't know if that's the best thing to do, but I mean, in terms of my intellectual formation, definitely Saint Thomas. In terms of spiritual life, I'm really drawn to Saint John of the Cross, Francis de Sales, Saint Benedict. Well, for the intellectual life also, I'm drawn to Dionysius. I am drawn to Bonaventure, even though I'm not in the Franciscan school of thought. But yeah, those are just some. I don't really want to get too deeply into that, but
yeah, my confirmation saint was actually Saint John of the Cross. All of my friends, all their confirmation saints were Saint Thomas. And I chose Saint John of the Cross. Maybe it was my own desire for individuality, but I really actually do personally find myself drawn to him. I think he's a very profound theologian as well when it comes to issues of grace. I think he's definitely under appreciated for his theological insights, which I think that the Dominican School of Spirituality has actually taken in a lot of his insights when it comes to theological insights, not merely spiritual insights.
Well, I also feel like his spirituality is increasingly underappreciated, especially when you consider, I think much of the charismatic movement, I think, could use a lot more of a Carmelite touch.
I think, personally, with St. John of the Cross, I think, unfortunately, he just gets abused. Because everybody, you basically have somebody who will go to, go to Mass and get super excited about the Catholic faith because they're a new convert or whatever. And then like 3 months in, they kind of, you know, that sort of natural excitement wears off. And they go into a Discord group and they're like, oh, I have this, like, you know, I'm starting not to like feel the fuzzies when I go to Mass. And then everybody's like, oh, yeah, Dark Night of the Soul. You got to read it. And like, it's we can laugh about it. But no, when you very deeply read St. John of the Cross, it's clear that the Dark Night of the Soul is in the night of sense, you have pleasure in no sensible things, not anything. It's not like, you know, you stop feeling the warm fuzzies at Mass and you want to fornicate. It's you don't feel enjoyment in any creative thing,
right? Because it's more about the motion of deeper spiritual intimacy. So it's not something to be conflated with like depression,
yeah, exactly.
Something like that. No, this is a stage of spiritual development. It's a stage of spiritual progress. In order to attain the highest degree of Christian perfection, you have to enter through that stage of remotion. You have to enter through that stage of detaching oneself from that desire for
sensitive goods.
Yeah, sensible goods. I was going to say just sensible pleasure, but it's even beyond that. It's beyond that. It's like sensible goods, created goods. I think like you were saying, there has to be a detachment from that in order to turn toward deeper intimacy with God. So
I think another thing that St. John of the Cross kind of just, you know, pushes to the forefront that would be helpful is the same thing that Gary Gu ends up beating everybody over the head with is the unity of the development of grace in the soul throughout its stages from the initial conversion all the way to mystical union. Is the fact that grace is the seat of glory. Grace is grace is the seat of glory and everything leading up to glory. So grace is also the seat of infused contemplation. Grace is the seat of the mystical union. Grace is the seat of the gifts of the Holy Ghost, of the infused moral virtues, of the theological virtues. Grace is the seed of all of that stuff and the full flowering forth of the soul and the beatitudes and the fruits as well. And I think a lot of times people forget how powerful grace is when you cooperate and dispose yourself to its working. Is grace can bring you as far as you dispose yourself for it to work within you.
Right, because it's the beginning of deification. Like it is, like you were saying, it is the seed planted that left to its own devices, conjoined with the absolute absence of resistance. A part of the will flower into the fullness of Christian perfection that God has seemed fit to provide for you.
So, oh no. I don't know if you want to at all talk about this. I think it actually might be a bit helpful.
Oh no, I saw the word holding and I'm like,
Yeah. Do you want to just skip that or do you
I don't really want to,
you don't really want to talk about it? Okay. That's fine.
Well, let me read the question.
I was just saying
there's anything in there that might be like worthwhile to talk about here.
I was thinking that we could just briefly basically talk about what we talked about in the Telegram chat.
Yeah. And you know, like Christian and I, it's okay that like we have, I think primarily what it is it's a pastoral disagreement.
Mm.
I tend to be of the school of thought that when we're dealing with disputed questions in moral theology, disputed questions about which Catholics, you know, moral theologians, like authorities in the church,
mm-hmm.
Today and in the past, moral theologians of good standing have disagreed. I think it's typically good practice for laymen who are not entrusted with care for souls in the way that pastors are, in the way that spiritual directors are, in the way that confessors are. I think it's wise for us to avoid pontificating on those disputed questions in such a way that you give the impression that your view as a layman, as a non-licensed moral theologian,
mm-hmm.
as if to give the impression that your view is like manifestly certain to bind the consciences of others around you. Mm-hmm. I think I'm just kind of calling for a greater humility, a more of a conversational tone about these things rather than an authoritative tone, which I can't claim for myself. I don't think any, you know, layman on Catholic Twitter can claim for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that that questions that are of this level of fine moral detail are best dealt with within the context of spiritual direction and within the context of confession. That being said, if we were going to salvage from this, I think what has become kind of like an ugly dispute on Catholic Twitter, if we were going to salvage anything from that, we can, and I think we should, speak at the very least about the supererogatory value of cultivating more of an ascetical lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
which I think will, you know, lead to people seeing it as more spiritually advisable to exercise greater caution in the indulgence of even illicit pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. And I think that's a thing to cultivate, but it should be cultivated in a way that is, again, from the standpoint of humility, from the standpoint of counsel, not from the standpoint of precept, if there's enough dispute, like the legumenon disputation mm-hmm. on the question, particularly among laymen. So that's my
opinion. At least like on this realm of questions, I think you would admit that the most refined position is going to come from the explanations that Hassan gives, and with the qualifications he gives about the specific circumstances in which it becomes sinful and the abundant circumstances in which it's not sinful and the specific character of that sin and so on and so on. Once the distinctions are kind of laid out, it doesn't become a ridiculous position. It's a reasonable position. I do have a problem because I mean, I agree with Hassan on this. I do have a problem when it gets just, you know, stated by supporters of the position in a very loose way. Because if any position that you state in a very loose way like that can look very ridiculous. So just like, you know, going out and tweeting with no context, like you're going to hell if you hold your hand, if your girlfriend's hand. That's a terrible way of going about it.
And some do go about it this way. Yeah. Yeah.
And on that second point that you said, this is really the place within Catholic sexual ethics that I myself have tried to really emphasize when it comes to the role of the councils, both keeping them effectively with an A and then effectively with an E, and how those two relate to the spiritual life and the perfection of charity in the spiritual life versus I think one of the biggest problems, and you've said that you don't think it's as big of a problem. You think there's bigger problems, but mm-hmm. you know, that's whatever. I think it's one of the bigger problems, but the, how do I state this in a non-meme way? You know, I'm just going to state it. I call it quote, Coomer Catholicism. And I mean, there's probably a better word to use for it, but I mean, it is what it is. I haven't thought of a better term, but basically the sort of ideology of sexual license amongst trad Catholics in marriage. And we know it extends also before marriage in a lot of instances, but that at least not on the surface. But in a lot of these cases with the quote Coomer Catholicism and the sexual license that they put forward, Catholicism becomes a hedonistic religion. And it's very, very disturbing. And we're not called to in by grace to, you know, hit the minimum of, you know, vaguely Christian natural law. We are called to the perfection of grace and in charity by the universal call to holiness.
Yeah. I think all that is good. And if I were to give any caveat to that, it would just be when we're dealing with increases in that kind of detachment from sensuality that mm-hmm. is the ultimate goal for, you know, all Christians ultimately, because that's the apex of that is the beatific vision. Mm-hmm. I think that it should be stressed to people that while we're all sort of as the viators, while we're all on this universal call to holiness and we're all on this trajectory, I think we should, in terms of understanding practically and pragmatically, okay, what are therefore the next steps within my circumstances to attain greater virtue and attain greater spiritual perfection? That is not something for the individual Christian that I think that it can be adjudicated by conversations on Twitter. Like that has to be dealt with like within the context of spiritual direction and confession and pastoral guidance, like actual pastoral guidance. Mm-hmm. So while we can speak about what the ideals are, and while we can exhort people to prioritize that kind of those kind of ascetical aspirations in their spiritual life, and I think that's good. In terms of where people should be moving, what are the next steps for people? That's something that I think we dare not tread,
mm-hmm.
at least in terms of speaking authoritatively, because we don't have that authority over people.
Yeah, I think there's a, and this is what I think actually Pope Francis will get into a lot about moral theology, moral direction, generally speaking, is a sort of rigorous attachment to specific formulations mm-hmm. of the perfection of the virtues. Because really, I think at least what I see my place in the whole like ascetical discourse around the marital use, the place is one that's defensive. It's it's defending the traditional teaching against common misconceptions and against the Coomer Catholicism that gets preached by some figures. But on the other hand, I do think that a broad statement of possibility and actuality, not making it some weird thing. I think there's something similar that happens in fasting. When people mm-hmm. people generally talk about and act like sort of fasting is normal, then people feel a lot more comfortable practicing it. And people like when people say, okay, today's Friday, don't eat meat. and you know, that's just a sort of general cultural thing within trad circles, at least. So most people actually practice it within trad circles, where in other circles, if you're in a sort of community that doesn't really keep the Friday abstinence from meat, it's just not really a thing. And obviously this is a little bit different with the marital use. You're not just gonna, like, go on Twitter, okay, receiving the Eucharist in 3 days, not using the marital use for the next 3 days. You're not doing that. But I think at least it's an equivalent form.
People will make group chats about it.
yeah, we're making group chats about it and stuff.
Yeah, people will do that.
You know, the anime profile pictures and such. Doing it. But I'm messing around, guys. I love my anime profile picture supporters just as much as the rest.
Yeah, they're our greatest ally.
They are our greatest ally.
But you know, I think it also is important that we contextualize all that within, I think, in a clearly articulated way, so as, at least in my opinion, so as not to give off unnecessary scrupulosity. We should talk about the principle of supererogation with some of these things, not all of them, but some of these things. is important, so that people don't, like, if they grab hold of this ascetical aspirational goal, but they conflate that with what is binding on them by way of precept, that can be very spiritually tough on people, and it can inhibit progress.
I agree, but my only fear is that if we cut too sharply the distinction between counsel and command, which obviously need to remain distinguished, we can present this two-tier spirituality when the spiritual writers are very clear the perfection of the spiritual life is found in these detachments. And obviously I know you agree with that, but this is more
for sure.
So I was talking about pragmatic manners.
Yeah.
Is if we cut that distinction too large, people aren't going to at all find that this is relevant for them. It might be relevant for some super holy, married saints. And on the other hand, if you don't cut it enough, then you'll have people who will make a wreck of their own spiritual lives because, you know, they're married and they need to engage in marital use, that, and then it's just the end of the world, and they're, you know, gonna go to hell because
and they might think that, okay, well, these goals are so lofty, I'm never gonna reach those. Mm-hmm. So why do I bother even keeping what are obvious precepts? Mm-hmm. You know, if the road to heaven requires that I here and now reach that goal, then I can't reach that goal. So why am I scrupulously trying to avoid things like lying, like unnatural acts, you know, things like that. So I think for that reason, I think it's important to maintain, to clearly articulate the distinction while also understanding that it's not as though they exist in two fully separate spheres. There's overlap, and one is, like, precepts are, you know, they have to be kept, but they are also calls to greater intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think I guess a missing category in this discourse often becomes deliberate venial sin, and a lot of times you just have, like, mortal sin and perfection, and deliberate venial sin and the cultivation of virtues, which is the ascetical life, the contradiction of the will. That's the ascetical life. The ascetical life kind of just becomes, okay, I stopped mortally sinning, now let me, you know, keep effectively the counselor or like whatever. So there's really no in between. And a lot of people, because of this, they see perfection as too far.
Yeah.
And they see mortal sin, avoiding mortal sin, as their only duty. They kind of just have this like survivalist mentality. If I keep free from mortal sin my whole life, and I just kind of like keep that at the door, I'm going to be good. I'm going to be good. I just kind of keep my little Catholic practices, keep away from mortal sin. But deliberate venial sin isn't something that ends up being dealt with. And the cultivation of virtues isn't something that ends up being dealt with.
And there is also the fact that, and I got to go in a minute here, but, but there is also the fact that, you know, just making it ultimately to heaven, that, of course, that attains perfect beatitude, but we shouldn't, I think, just not see as important the differences in degrees of glory. Like, that's important to want to attain the highest degree of glory that God has allowed for you to realize by his grace is important. And why is that? Well, it's because like the highest degree of glory isn't just for your own perfection, is that it's determined by the degree to which you love God. So if you love God and you want to love him more, then that should inspire a desire to cultivate those, even those supererogatory degrees of virtue. So so it really does stem toward loving God. Like that is the root of the motivation to grow deeper and deeper in those counsels throughout your life, like throughout the course of your decades of living. So it's not as if like if you have to do all of it like now. You have to keep all the precepts now. You have to avoid mortal sin and, of course, deliberate venial sin now, here and now. But keeping those precepts in themselves, you do those out of love of God, but that love of God, if you want to truly cultivate that love of God, will inspire you to go beyond those. So that's what I'd have to say about that.
Okay, I think on that note, thank you, CT, for stopping by. That was
thanks so much for having me on.
Yep, and I will talk to everybody later. CT has to go, and I have to go as well. So thank you, everybody, and as always, God bless.
All right.